There's a sweet and virgin land. There's a sweet and virgin land. I know because I have been there. Flowers blooming by the sea move a place inside of me. Wild earth and wild sea and clean air. It's my sweet Oregon home, where the bear and the elk still can roam. Oh, take care of my Oregon home, 'cause it's worth more than gold.
And good morning. This is Wednesday Talk Radio here on KBOO Community Radio. That was a blast from the past. We're going to talk about the times that song came out, Cecilia Ostro, Troubadour of and for the Forest. That was from a Brighton Bush, a concert to save the forest. And my guest is Michael Donnelly. Good morning, Michael.
Hey, good morning, Paul.
And Brave New Logging in the Brighton Bush Watershed. Brave New Age Logging. What does the New Age have to do with it? We'll talk about all this. And first, Michael is currently president of the Friends of Brighton Bush Cascades, has been for several decades, right?
Yeah, 30-some years.
30-some years. And still has one of those incredible Forest Service cabins there right near the Brighton Bush Hot Springs Retreat and Conference Center. And so we're going to be talking about new logging that's proposed for the Brighton Bush watershed after decades of pretty strong protection that he had a major role in. I had a minor role in. So most people in the KBOO radio signal area are probably familiar with the Brighton Bush Hot Springs. I imagine the just incredibly beautiful retreat conference center with the world-class hot springs in the beautiful, lush, ancient forest there in the Brighton Bush River watershed just east of Salem, nestled right up against the Cascades just below Patu, right? Mount Jefferson.
Yes.
And but a lot of people might not know the backstory of why most of that drainage was spared from the massive logging onslaught that raised to the ground about 95% or more. I don't know what is the figure. We'll maybe have some answers about that one. But the original forest of the Pacific Northwest, until it was slowed down in part by the movement that Michael and I participated in, the forest protection movement of the 1980s and 90s. And Michael was, as I said, instrumental to the protection of that watershed, along with many, many, many others, as lead plaintiff in the first ever lawsuit to specifically protect ancient or old growth forests. It was also known as the Cumulative Effects lawsuit. And that took place at Brighton Bush. So a little more intro. In 1986, I, myself, Paul Rowland, was a fairly new arrival in Portland. I was working at the Portland Alliance newspaper where, somebody involved with that movement was helping work on an insert for a Rainforest Action Network and told me all about Brighton Bush and took me down there. And I had I guess there had been three tree sitters that had just come down. These are the first three of the first four or five tree sitters in history, Pacific Northwest activism history. And so anyway, I borrowed a hammock and brought a sleeping bag, and that's about it. And there was a bunch of people around the campfire there at the bridge over on 85
was the road along the 46. South Brighton Bush Wild and Scenic River.
Yeah, which had not had a bridge over it, which was part of the fight.
Mm-hmm.
And so that road, they're going to make a bridge, or had already.
No, that was when they were going to build the bridge.
They were going to build the bridge. Yeah, because they had because the people who were in the trees were in the road right of way, which mm-hmm. was basically that was the strategy at the time,
mm-hmm.
was to stop the road from going in because you need a road to take out the trees. Anyway, and Michael was business manager at Brighton Bush at the time, and so we met. So I was up 90 feet in the air in a Douglas fir for 3 days, And as it was an amazing, it was like kind of a big jump in the level of attention to the issue. I remember when I was up in the tree, there was a TV news crew flying in a helicopter. It was probably the first time. Came down, there was like a TV news crew on me right away. I mean, this is like, this stuff hadn't been happening. There hadn't been, the Oregonian hadn't been covering it, the TV news hadn't been covering it. So this is like a real hard to imagine times that we live. So anyway, so that's how we got involved in this movement. And Cecilia Ostro, talk a little bit about Cecilia.
Yeah, the movement always had a bunch of great musicians and troubadours. And that clip you had was a concert in the forest that happened at Breitenbach, and I think around 86 as well. And Jim Scott, who's a musician, and Eugene, part of the Paul Winter concert, was put together a two-week period where all these various musicians came and wrote songs. And then at the end of 2 weeks, we had a concert, and we recorded it, and we put out two cassettes at the time. That was the technology, and raised money to save the forest. And Cecilia was one of our great allies.
Yeah, July 1986.
Yeah,
and you heard from, that's probably the first cassette that's been played at KBOO in a while that I've played. And yes, she was an incredible inspiration. She was, you know, on the first Earth First Road Show back in 82, 83, somewhere around there. And yeah, so that's sort of then, and we're going to talk about this logging project called the Highway 46 Thinning Project, and we're going to talk about a lot of the, you know, I said brave new logging. It's very, very apt, because the idea of newspeak that came out in that book, Brave New World, is very common. Certainly, we see it now with all over the place with Trumpisms, and it's been used, taken up by the Forest Service to describe logging by many, many other names. So we're going to talk about this Highway 46, so-called thinning project, and which Michael has been gotten back involved in the struggle here to try to stop. There's an article that came out December 21st in Eugene White Weekly called Highway 46 Project Can't Catch a, quote, fire break. And all this is linked to on the program page for this show, kbo.fm/Wednesday Talk Radio. There's a much older article from last year called How the Naked Hiker Saved the Forest. We'll give you a more complete history of this. So let's go back to the, before we talk about Highway 46 and the current threats, talk about what led up to how you got to Breitenbach.
Okay. I'd first heard about Breitenbach right when Alex Beamer and friends were looking for, had bought it, you know, to buy the Breitenbach, the old Hot Springs Resort in the Cascade, and start restoring it in 1977. And I first went there in 1979.
And that had been around since like the early part of the...
Yeah, the late 20s.
Late 1920s.
When the first resort got built. Yeah. Went out of business in like 67. And it was out of business for 10 years. And during that time, that's when the Forest Service decided to come in gung-ho, putting roads everywhere and logging the heck out of the area.
Oh, so they kind of held off because of the existence of the hot springs.
I'm not so sure of that, but they eventually got around to it. Okay. And then during the time when no one was there. And then we got there, and then I was living up in northeastern Washington at the Yarrow Land Trust then, but it eventually moved down to Eugene. And while I was in Eugene for a couple of years in the early 80s, I was coming up to Breitenbach and plugging into projects and working on some of the restoration work. And a bunch of my friends were moving there and so on. And I wasn't really ready to move there. And
it was kind of part of the satellite of the intentional
movement.
Communities that had
Yeah, it was the communities movement
out
thing.
Of the, yeah.
And but finally, Dinah Ross. And I can't talk about this without talking about Dinah Ross. Dinah Ross was the godmother of the ancient forest movement. She filed the first ever appeal of an old growth timber sale. And if you ever go up to Breitenbach, this was 1979, if you ever go up to Breitenbach, when you leave the paved road, the gravel road, the mile and a half gravel road from the paved road into the Brightmoor's parking lot. Every single big tree that's standing there is standing today because of that appeal that Dinah filed. And Dinah, one day, she really got into it and researched what was coming, you know. And so she was hiking the forest, checking out these areas that were on the auction block. She took me. We drove up to a trailhead to a lake, and intentionally, I'm sure she did this, because we went through miles of fresh clear cuts. It was just brutal. And then she explained to me what was on tap for the whole Brightmoor's drainage. And we looked at the maps, and she said, hey, would you consider coming and helping? And I said, sure. That convinced me, that trip. And so that was in 83. And so then I moved to Brightmoor's, and Brightmoor's was still in the restoration era of restoring the place. It hadn't become a full-on retreat center yet. It was way more in the intentional community experiment era, which was one of the main reasons I went, too, was because of that. And Dinah, unfortunately, was tragically killed. And ironically, I don't know how you call it, what you'd call this, but she was driving along Detroit Lake, and a truckload of veneer that had been cut from old growth from a timber sale, she tried to stop, tipped over on her truck, and killed her and her new sweetie instantly.
So it had gone over the line.
It went around a curve too fast and tipped over is what happened.
But, geez, that's just...
Which was a huge shock to everybody. She was our Brightmoor's representative to the, first it was called the Oregon Wilderness Coalition, which was a collection of local grassroots groups like our Friends of the Brightmoor's Cascades and so on. It ended up becoming the Oregon Natural Resources Council. It's now morphed through the years. It's called Oregon Wild. But it is a statewide environmental group and was instrumental in starting the ancient forest movement. And anyway, that's how I got there. And then all of a sudden, there had been some timber sales that had been sold in the heyday of high bids in the 70s, and then the recession happened in the early Reagan years. And so these timber sales got turned back to the Forest Service, and then they were going to resell them. And we have started to appeal these sales, and that's what started it. And some of them were on Devil's Ridge. And the North Roaring Devil one, which you talked about, was the key one that really jump-started activism at Brightmoor's, because I'd say the community was probably 75% totally in favor of it. Numerous members of the community were blockading roads and being arrested in nonviolent civil disobedient protests like yourself.
Which, again, you know, going back to that time, I remember... You know, I was such a newbie at the time. I hadn't heard of Brightmoor's up to that point. I didn't know, you know, like so many people. I didn't know, like so many people end up coming west to get involved in the movement. Also, I didn't know about, you know, anything about the ancient forest. In fact, a lot of the science was really just catching up to the you know, beginning to understand how the ancient forests worked before they, you know, all got cut down. A lot of stuff was happening, new stuff was happening. Yeah. It all kind of converged. Yeah. So I was just, you know, one of those things. But anyway, the sense I got was that there was, it was kind of a little hush-hush, you know, that you know, you didn't want to advertise the fact that, like, say, I remember, I think we got to, you know, use the hot tub, the community hot tubs on the other side of the river. It was all really hush hush. You know, didn't want people to know that they were letting people sleep there, you know, because, you know, realistically, you know, at the time, it's completely changed now. But, you know, Brightmoor's was this island of, you know, counterculture in a sea of, you know, very
big timber,
and you know, serious logging economy, and, you know, a fair amount of hostility, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah,
you could talk a little bit. You obviously experienced that more. So anyway, so there's a sort of dynamic going on that, you know, as you said, I didn't realize that so much of the community was supporting it. I also got the feeling, though, there's these tensions that some people were, you know, didn't want people to stay there. But it seems like there's a lot more solid against the, you know, to actually be involved in the mm-hmm. direct actions, which I'm sure they went through their own learning curve too, because I mean, you don't start out doing direct action.
It was an amazing time, and we had meetings there and brought in ecologists, and you know, it went on. It was a heady times, to say the least. Okay, but yeah, the community kind of supported it. Let me talk a little bit more about the history of it, then we'll go into what's happening now. We got the time. What ended up happening is partly as a result of the lawsuit, the forest plans all got rewritten for the Northwest. And eventually it became the Northwest Forest Plan, the famous Clinton Plan, which stopped a lot of the, it certainly stopped the liquidation program.
So let's go back here a second. So you're saying that the lawsuit that you are lead plaintiff on, and there's a couple other plaintiffs, actually helped lead directly to the
It helped push to that, because what ended up happening is through our appeal to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, it ended up being that the Forest Service did start looking at old growth as a ecosystem worthy of analyzing on its own, and had to restructure their forest plans. You know, partly that the main lawsuit that led to that was not our lawsuit. It was the lawsuit over the spotted owl, you know, that had been filed by big environmental groups, you know, and that had led to an injunction and all logging stopped everywhere. And they wanted the Clinton Forest Plan actually restarted the logging that we had stopped under Bush the First. And but the important thing about it was that it required the new plans to have to consider the old growth ecosystem. And that led to what are called late successional reserves, LSRs, which were habitat areas that were set aside for spotted owls, because they are the indicator species. There's about 110 species that the health of the spotted owls indicates the health of those species. And so these late successional reserves are created. And what happened at Brightonbush was the very area that was on the block to be cut along Devil's Ridge ended up becoming an LSR. And it's a 49,000 acre area, and it's the LSR that has more spotted owls surviving in it than any in all of Oregon. You know, so it's the heart of it.
And you've seen spotted owls there.
Yeah, one of the great ironies is we were calling it the Spotted Owl Trail before we built it. We had this agreement with the Forest Service to build a trail around these summer homes so people could hike up there, and we were calling it Spotted Owl Knob, and we met the owls the day we were building the trail, and that helped save, that really played into it, and stopped 170 acres of planned clear cuts immediately. And then, like I said, now the whole area's grown to a 49,000 acre area. But as we found out earlier this year with the fires, the late successional reserves are not inviolate. The very late successional reserve at Brightonbush now has a 2-mile-long, 70-foot-wide fire line that was cut through it because of the fires that broke out up on top of Devil's Ridge. And they cut them right along the Emerald Forest Loop Trail. If you've ever been to Brightonbush, it was a trail that I and some other friends created with some help with the Forest Service, figuring it all out. And we built it and agreed to maintain it, and we've maintained it for over 30 years. And yet this fire line got cut right over without anybody even talking to us, you know. And
same old.
And of course, the fire line was useless. I mean, the fire that it was cut for never got anywhere near close to it. Right after they cut it, ironically, another fire broke out closer to it, but it never got to it either. And of course, it flies in the face of science. I mean, an old growth forest is the best fire break you can have. Fires have been breaking out on top of Devil's Ridge for centuries, and if they do work their way down the ridge, by the time they get down into the shadier, wetter, cooler old growth, they're usually a ground fire, and they stall out until nature comes along and puts them out with rain and snow, just like she did this year. But that's the first logging and the first stump creation that's happened in that area since the time of...
And I know that there's, over the years that there's been some continuing tensions or new tensions, conflicts that you have had with some people at Brightonbush. And without getting, you know, too deep into, these personal conflicts, what I heard is that, and I don't know if they had to be consulted or whatever, but I think you were telling me that there's some people at Brightonbush who actually agreed to have that,
I'll get into this a little bit. Yeah, Brightonbush, they were consulted by the Forest Service. The Forest Service wanted their buy-in on this fire line. And so the management of Brightonbush, three people went out there with the Forest Service and gave their approval of it. And I did a Freedom Information Act request to find out all the stuff on it. And the Forest Service has some documentation of somebody was saying, well, is the fire line approved at Brightonbush? And And the answer was, yes, the community loved it. Approval is granted. Anyway, yeah, I have some conflicts right now with the management of Brighton Bush that this is a big part of. You know, I mean, the Brighton Bush has, they've monetized the eco cachet that came from our past history of saving the forest for years. They even run an ad on OPB on their NewsHour that talks about coming out and staying at their retreat in the pristine ancient forests. And yet now there's a lot of stumps that Brighton Bush has had a hand in creating. And that brings me up to the current thing, the Highway 49 project.
Let me give the phone number. This is a talk show. We do encourage your participation. If you have any calls and comments, please try to make them as germane, relevant to the conversation as possible. 503-231-8187. I'm speaking with Michael Donnelly. He is currently president of the Friends of Brighton Bush Cascades, has been for 3 decades. And as you heard, if you didn't hear, he has a deep history being a member of the community of Brighton Bush for several years and participating deeply in the effort to protect that watershed, which is, you know, one of the, you know, there just wasn't that much of the, what's that, mid-level, you call that mid-elevation?
Oh, yeah, that lower elevation, you know, temperate rainforest, there's just, it's incredibly rare. You talked about 95%. Yes, 95% of the original forest was liquidated and replaced, you know. And that was an amazingly rare ecosystem. I've got to go back to the thing with the fire line. One of the reasons that the fire line is so upsetting to me, not only the fact that it's not, there's no evidence-based science that one of those ever worked in an ancient forest, like they said, is that it created an opening, this corridor into the heart of the late successional reserve. The reason the spot owls can survive there is they are the top, they're the indicator species because they can outmaneuver any of their predators in the multi-layered canopy of the forest. The multi-layered canopy of the forest is not there. In fact, right next to a nest tree that they'd nested in, even has a little sign on this tree, they created a huge opening. Well, the owls were in that thick area because they could raise their young there and teach them to fly there and protect them while they were doing it. Well, there's been some serious impact on the owls, you know, and that's why I'm sad about the trail being trashed and the fact that there's like 1,000 stumps along it now when there weren't any, and there's thousands of giant rounds of big wood. When they cut these trees down, they just chopped them up and rolled them to the bottom side of the trail because they actually were planning on back burning from the trail up toward the fire. At least we were able to not have that happen. But so yeah, I'm sad about the trail being lost, you know. I mean, to me it's kind of, it's really sad, you know. I mean, it's like it's losing a child to me. You know, I mean, I'm one of the organizers and maintainers of it. But that's not the thing that is most important to me. It's the habitat loss. And, yeah, we can go on. So, yeah, there's problems with the Brighton Bush management these days. The fact that they would consider sacrificing this priceless ecosystem in order to protect their buildings, which none of them are over 90 years old even. Buildings can be rebuilt. Nobody can grow a 500-year-old ecosystem, you know, and that's just astounding to me. That's so much different than the ethic of Brighton Bush during the era of Dinah and myself, you know. And part of that is Brighton Bush has gotten big and they got more to protect, you know, and so a whole lot going on there. There's a lot. You know, I describe that as like the loss of a child to me. Well, it's almost like a loss of a lover to me, the fact that Brighton Bush is not this egalitarian community experiment anymore. Instead, it's a corporation and with a top-down entrenched bureaucracy, et cetera, et cetera. Still uses the rhetoric of, you know, the intentional community stuff, but it's not that. Anyway, so that's my problems, you know, and hopefully we can work on it some, or who knows, you know, but
Well, you know, a lot of people, you know, who are listening have been to and appreciated Brighton Bush, and it is an incredibly beautiful place. No one could possibly dispute that. But it's, you know, it's important to, you know, you don't have to take Michael's word for it, but this is a point of view that's worth taking into consideration.
Yeah, people can go out there and hike the trail, go see what's going on. But what this has now led into is the Forest Service has this plan, the Highway 46 project, which up to 3,800 acres in the area immediately around Brighton Bush. Highway 46 is the paved road from Detroit that goes to Brighton Bush.
And then connects up with 224, which if you want to go the back way.
Yeah, the back way through Estacada.
Yeah.
Anyway, they have, Paul was talking about how they use all these different euphemisms for creating stumps. Well, they've got some really good ones now. Now they're going to be logging the forest to help the forest become resilient in the face of climate change. That one's, I've heard a lot of them, but that's one of the most creative. Paul's got somebody created a list of them. You know, they had a bunch of them. I used to like, clear cuts were non-declining even flow. That was one of them. Now they're, what are they? They're called regeneration harvests, you know, as a clear cut. You know, they've got all these various terms. But now the Highway 46 project with these 3,800 acres, I highly recommend that you check the links and look it up online and find it, because it's hard to explain. They're cutting trees. They're cutting other trees to free up sugar pine trees. They're cutting other old mature trees to enhance meadows. They're doing all kinds of stuff, you know. Their reasoning is, okay, we cut all this forest down 30 years ago when our best science told us that was the great thing to do, to liquidate the old growth forest and replace them with thrifty young stands. That's what they'd say. Well, now those thrifty young stands are showing up and they're a jungle and they call them overstocked because there's so many trees in them. And that's another reason they want to log all around there. And of course, fire. They're using fire just like with that fire break to scare everybody. One of the things in the FOIA I asked about was, what was the ecological rationale and the justification for doing this? You know, didn't you have to have some type of permission and this, that to go into this LSR? They sent me the thing. They had some biologist wrote a thing, a two-sentence thing basically saying, hey, it's an emergency, none of the rules apply. You know, that was it. You know?
That's a classic. That's what they did with the riders to build it. You know, they use what they call sufficiency language. It's already met the requirements of the law, so they can get around whatever law there might be. Yeah.
Oh, and they're gonna try that again. I really see that Wyden and some of our politicians, Walden, the rest of them, are gonna go for a thing that will trade off suspending the laws again, so this can go through without us being able to sue, in exchange for getting the big money they want for their firefighting budget to be permanently put in there. I'm predicting that right now on this show, and that's another thing we're up against.
Well, we're going to be up against more and more stuff like that because of the terrible restrictions, budgetary restrictions, that are already existent but are getting worse and worse because we've got this person in the White House and an administration that is into privatizing everything and completely drowning the
baby in the bath.
Yeah, there's some phrase. Anyway, I think it was
make government so small they can drown it in a tub or something.
Right, right. Yeah. Wasn't that a Milton Friedman? I think. Yeah.
No.
Anyway. So the number again, I see people haven't called yet. Please feel free to call in with your questions or comments for my guest, Michael Donnelly, here in this important conversation, not just about Breitenbach, a more general, I've had people from BARC, the local Forest Protection Mount Hood group, on who are facing timber sales with exactly similar excuses being used, which we've talked about on the show and others here on KBOO. So call up at 503-231-8187. Go ahead.
I want to read what Peter Moore, the director of Breitenbach's administration, says about this Highway 46 project. He says, and this is in the article that's in the Eugene Weekly that you can link to on the kboo.com link.
.fm.
.fm, right, got you. Okay. Peter Moore, they're talking about allowing for some work to be created and some product to be brought from the woods, which sounds more like Robbie Ferrers, the timber local canyon timber guy, than the head of Breitenbach. Work and product. Compared to the 80s and 70s, when they were taking out billions of board feet and the Detroit district was cutting more than any other district in the lower 48 state, this is a tiny amount compared to that. Well, hey, you know, the fascists are killing a lot less undesirables now than they did in the past, too. We're slaughtering a lot less buffalo than we did in the past. You know, we don't dump as many toxins in the rivers as we did in the past. Just because there's less stumps now, a tiny amount compared to that, that's not any scientific justification for what they're planning. That doesn't make sense.
Well, besides the idea that they're creating work.
Yeah, well, the creating work one is really bizarre because I mentioned Robbie Ferris. The Ferris Mill right now, what they're building is they're making plywood that's 4 inches thick, 4 feet wide, and 32 and a half feet long. And they're actually using it to make multiple story buildings now. Nobody's going down to Home Depot and buying that, you know? And that's highly automated product. There's not a lot of jobs in that. You know, that's where it's going to end up.
Yeah, so it looks like we got a couple callers. Aaron is first on deck. Go ahead.
Hi, I think it's Karen.
Karen, sorry.
And I have a question. Climate is obviously changing, and I wondered if you could give us your ideas on what sustainable kinds of forest practices we need, since it is changing. I'm not talking about the bull twaddle ideas that come from the corporations, but real suggestions for how we have sustainable forest practice. Okay, that's my question. Thank you.
Okay, this is Michael. I'll take that. 95% of the original forest has already been converted. If they can't get enough wood out of the plantations that are there, cutting into the other 5% is not going to help. And exports are huge. See, I'm a former timber industry worker. In my 20s, I worked in the mills. All along through this, I've always been sympathetic to the worker part of it. But there's plenty of trees being grown. The amount of waste in the landfills of wood is astonishing. You know, I mean, I just don't think the national forest should be a timber supply for the private timber industry anymore. I think the national forest should be managed in the era of climate change as carbon sinks. And I think there should be carbon offsets that are charged, taxed to the airline industry, the Pentagon, all the transportation industry, all the huge carbon users should be supporting the Forest Service to grow trees, not grow timber.
Yeah, you mentioned the, I don't know what percentage of it is, but like a simple change in the law to allow, discarded two-dimensional 2x4s and 2x6s to be used structurally. That's insane.
I've got a story on that. I did an addition on my cabin, and I had to go through the county, permitting process, and I had all of this recycled lumber I had that was really good, and they wouldn't let me use it unless I hired a grader to come and grade it. And if that was the case, it would have costed me more than buying new stuff from Home Depot. It's a racket. You can't use the recycling.
That's why salvage groups can't afford to do it. I actually wasn't aware that was the actual reason why people don't reuse that. I thought it was just like you couldn't do it because they had nail holes in it or something stupid like that. But
No, if you get someone to come out who's a certified grader and grade it for you, you can use it, but that was impractical.
Right. Looks like we got another caller. Harry, go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning, and thank you for taking my call. The question I have is associated with it. They're talking about forest planning. What about they do clear cutting? Whatever happened to selective cutting?
Think that too. They do a lot more selective cutting than clear cutting than they used to, and especially on public lands. But we still see clear cuts, and generally when you see a good big size clear cut, it's private land. The Oregon Forest Practice Act allows that on private land. We were able to get them on public land to keep reducing the size of clear cuts over the year until finally they weren't doing any of them that were more than 60 acres. But I think now there's not a lot of clear cuts, the regeneration harvest as they call it in this Highway 46 plan.
Right, but they still do take out
the
trees.
They're still doing them. They call them more like patch cuts because they're smaller. They aren't big 60 acre cut. They might be 4 or 5 acres. But still, the reason they always did clear cut is because they were selecting for Douglas fir. Douglas fir trees do not germinate and grow in the shade of the canopy. That's why when you look in the oldest forest, the climax forest, there's a lot of big hemlocks there. Hemlocks and And cedars will grow in the shade, but not the Douglas firs. So that's why they stripped it off so they could get Douglas fir growing. The Douglas fir, the original old growth Douglas fir, started when way back when landslides or, you know, fires caused it, and that's how it could get started. But once it started, it closes itself off, you know.
Okay, my next question is the Douglas fir tree that you were up in there 30 feet high.
90 feet.
90 feet high. Is that Douglas fir tree still there?
Oh, no. Actually, the Forest Service, the lovely Forest Service, they actually had a probably unofficial policy. I don't know if it was written down. But when we started, you know, chaining ourselves to trees, especially climbing in trees, their policy was to cut it down immediately when you came down, even at night, which was illegal. They did that to some people who came down at night. Yeah. They would put their big arc Klieg lights on and cut it right down. No, they can be very punitive.
Yeah. As far as I know, all the trees that people did tree sits in on public land have been cut down. There's a tree sit on public timber land that Julia Butterfly did for a long time, and people got together and bought that tree, and it still stands. But I think that was the thing. They didn't want any, you know, like shrines.
Okay. And you mentioned earlier about the types of trees in this forest. You said they want Douglas fir, but you mentioned hemlock. You mentioned, I think, cedar. Is there any other trees? Are they actually planting these trees also, or is it just Douglas fir only?
For years and years and years, they were planting just Douglas fir in their clear cuts, and these were hybridized trees, you know, that they genetically enhanced. And that's what's in all these plantations that are 30 to 40 years old now that are overstocked is Douglas fir. Toward the end of the big clear-cutting area, they did start mixing in some other trees, but they've never really done the same mix that was there to begin with.
Okay, hey, well, thank you for taking my call.
Okay, and I also wanted to say that I this is probably not why he asked that question, but we didn't protect that tree, but the point is we did end up protecting
yes.
through direct. Well, the point of direct action was basically to hold them off until we could get our day in court, and we did get our day in court, and that, you know, that most of that watershed ended up being protected. But the other thing I want to say is, you know, I think they're also getting around these restrictions by having now these humongous sized sales, which are sometimes like 1,000 or 2,000 acres, and having many different kinds of cuts within it to add up to the board feet.
Yeah.
But, you know, the damage, you have to look at, it's all very abstract talking about it. The reality, you know, the ecosystem is beyond human, you know, comprehension. We think we can manage these things in a way, but this is an illusion. The ecosystem itself, you know, has its own requirements. It existed long before us. So anyway, just want to throw that. But again, 503-231-8187 is a number to call. So yeah, anything more about this 46 project before we,
Well, it's exactly what you were just describing. It's 3,800 acres, and it's all different rationales. Like I said, there's all these different reasons and different things, so that's why you got to really look through it. And it's like they threw everything and see what sticks, you know. And I guess ask for the moon and negotiate down. I guess that's what they're trying to do. But you brought up how, you know, I was, you know, getting back involved, you know, and you know, David Brower, the great arch druid, who was the executive director of the Sierra Club for years and years and years, he always used to say that, we have to be ever vigilant, because when you really get down to it, their victories are permanent and ours are temporary. And I look on it as, hey, we had a temporary victory. It lasted 30-some years, but now, hey, we got to, you know, gird up and go for it again. That's how I see it.
Their victories are permanent in the sense that destruction ends up being permanent.
Yeah.
Of course, their wealth is certainly not permanent. That ends up being an illusion too, and I think going to be a tragic illusion in the end, as given what we're doing. So let me. We wanted to get into another subject, we started to get into the subject of, I don't know. There's sort of these ideological divides, and you talked about. How the Brighton Bush management is relating to how are they relating to this Highway 46? Oh, you already
yeah, I read that. Well, at least the executive director is the business director is, you know, he put his favoring it, you know.
So speaking of which, I'm going to quote from, because this is something that I've talked a little bit about on the show. It's a theme that I've wanted to develop further, especially, you know, as we're coming up on the 50th anniversary here, this night in 2018, is that shocking? 2018, who would have thought we would have lived this long? So, in fact, Peter Moore, the person you're talking about, had an article in the spring 2016 Utney Reader called "My Intentional Community and the Law," and I'm just going to read about it, and we'll talk about it. In 1968, as a student at San Francisco State College, I came to know a local guru named Stephen Gaskin. He offered a thing called Monday night class in his living room in the Haight-Ashbury neighborhood near where I lived. This was at the height of the hippie era, with hundreds of communes, cults, and conspiracies flowering in the city. Whatever that means. It was at one of his talks where he said, in essence, when you live around dinosaurs and you know they're existentially unsustainable, your best survival strategy is to neither fight with them nor live with them, live under them. Why? If you fight a giant cold-blooded body that's bigger than you with lots of teeth, you don't stand a chance. And when that unsustainable body inevitably falls, you don't want to be under it for obvious reasons. Better to just do your own thing, live your life by your terms, and not attract too much attention. Now that is an expression of an ideology that is, I see that as kind of, from what I understood, there's very close to the what I consider the rainbow family ideology. That I've heard that expressed a number of times over the years. It's what, you know, led to a certain sort of conflict. There's been this historic conflict, you know, there's this conflict sort of between the hippies and the radical activists. You know, there's a sort of a conflict between like the Earth Firsters and the Rainbow Family. It kind of, this divide has, you know, and it goes way further back than that. So anyway, let's deconstruct this. So basically there is some people initially who went to Brighton Bush who were just like a lot of people in intentional communities who are just trying to basically escape mm-hmm. from the monster, trying to, you know, get away, do your own thing, mm-hmm. right? You know, a lot of people, like the people in Southern Oregon, some of the communities there in Williams and the other communities, you know, started to, you know, they found themselves there away from it all, and then they found themselves being dosed with herbicides, having logging mm-hmm. all around their washes such that, you know, their rivers were being destroyed and such. So, you know, it was hard to escape from, probably impossible. And B, I mean, the idea, you know, so there were some people who had that sure. idea and were in conflict with the people who wanted to actually stop the logging. But to me, this idea is delusional to me. I don't see a separation. I've never seen a separation between the idea of trying to create an alternative and trying to fight that which refuses to let the alternative exist.
Right. Yeah. I would say in the early days of Brighton Bush, you know, most of us were hiding out. We had our little, you know, hippie utopia in the woods, but and hiding out from civilization. But then civilization came to us in the form of the chainsaws and we'd wake up in the morning, the chainsaws and beepers and trees crashing, and then they'd burn the clear cuts when they were done. Before they'd plant them, they'd burn all the brush and stuff and the smoke. And I mean, it was so in our face, you know, that people really couldn't ignore it anymore, you know. But yes, there was always an element of Brighton Bush. There's always been the New Age element of Brighton Bush, which to me is, I would describe it as there's a little delusion in that, and there's certain, I see it as a kind of a white suburban elitist thing. You know, it's like, you know, we're all one, but it translates to, yeah, we're all one. I'm one up, you're one down. You know, there's and it leads to a lot of passive aggressiveness. That's one of the reasons why it took me so long to agree to even move there, was that type of passive aggressive stuff. Yeah, you can't just stick your head in the sand and hide. You know, there's just no way. It's a global situation here, and if you look at the original Brighton Bush credo, we talked about being global citizens and doing our part and being activists, you know. But that's just not there, you know. I see it as the New Agers won out over the communitarians.
Well, it looks like we got another caller. Looks like Lee is up on deck. If we can go to Lee. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I heard you use the term manage, and it's my understanding that a Doug Fir can live, you know, 1,000 years.
Yes.
And that, you know, after it's dead, it may stand, you know, 100, 200 years, and then when it finally falls, take another, you know, 100, 200 years to decompose.
Yeah, that's all true.
So how do you, you use the term manage, deconstruct that into two words, man age. How can you man age a species that lives 1,200, 1,400 years?
Yeah, right. I agree with you fully. You know, I always used to tell the Forest Service in the past, I said, you know, how did these forests limp along without our management? How did they get here all these years, you know, before we showed up on the scene?
But what they're telling you is that they're, you know, the rotation that they're using for cutting is exactly akin to a man's age.
Right, exactly.
You know, and that's the, they're telling you what they're doing, sort of like, you know, when they tell you that the list of shows on television is programming.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
Well, thank you for that.
Thank you.
Bye. Let's go right to Marilyn. Marilyn, you up?
Hey, I'm George.
Oh, George. Okay.
Hey, this is a terrific program, and I just wanted to add my opinion that as long as we are under the tyranny of an economy that says we've got to grow capital, instead of taking care of Mother Earth first, we're stuck with things that their victories will really tend to be long range, if not permanent, and ours, well, we might get some long ones, but the capitalists never give up. So I just think this is a terrific program. I'll get off the air here. I want to hear the rest of it. Thank you so much for doing it.
All right. Thank you.
Bless you.
I'd say that the growth thing is one of the issues at Brighton Bush itself. Back when we were under 35 people, we could be this egalitarian experiment, you know, in self-governance. But now Brighton Bush has gone and gotten so big that they have, you know, 80, 90 staff, you know. It makes it, they don't even have a place where they can meet as a group, you know. I mean, it's just, so growth is a big part of it, the same type of growth.
Now let's go to Marilyn. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Okay, so I have two questions. One is, what's the rationale for the support of the logging at Brighton Bush? And the second one is overstocked plantations of Doug Fir. What do you think? Do you think anything ought to be done with those?
Oh, okay.
Those are my two questions.
Okay, you mean what is the justification for the logging from the Forest Service's point of view or from
Brighton Bush's?
Well, I read what Peter Moore, the executive director, said. You know, he just thinks that it makes sense and that they aren't taking too many trees out and it's creating jobs and producing product. I mean, it's a strange rationale.
But it doesn't make any sense.
I know. It makes no sense to me.
So, okay.
But, and the other part of your question, what to do with the overstock plantations?
Yeah.
Well, I'd burn a few of them down. I would lop and scatter. I'd go in and I'd cut, you know, every other tree or however thick they are, and then just leave those other trees on the ground in order to decompose and become nutrients for us. You know, my feeling is if the humans disappeared tomorrow, nature would sort it out, and eventually there'd be an old growth forest there.
Yeah.
You know, so I don't think we have to do much about it. But
yeah. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you. Yeah. I mean, that whole issue of, you know, the private land plantation, I mean, that's something we never really addressed very well as a movement. What we should have done when we won the victory there with the Northwest Fort, the victory with the big asterisk, huge asterisk with the Northwest Forest Plan, we should have gone directly and started challenging the state land logging and private land logging. And we should have looked at it as an overview, but we you know, the movement itself as a whole never had, you know, a real social, economic, political analysis. you know, we never really had a strong analysis. We were looking.
I feel we were so up against it. We were trying to save what was left that still was pristine that we couldn't really concentrate on the plantations.
Anyway, that's a big issue. Let's go to John because we only have 10 minutes left. John, you're on the air.
Okay. Well, I thank you very much for taking my call, and I couldn't hardly restrain myself. I came here from Michigan in 1980, and my grandfather had property, and it was logged, and he listened to a forester. But you know, you got to understand from my perspective, and I'm a retired carpenter, but I love trees, and it's the whole. I came here to the land of trees. And I thought these wire Weyerhaeuser ads that we used to see in Life magazine was, oh, it's great, and they're doing a wonderful thing by clear-cutting these wonderful big trees and planting new ones. And what bothers me is that they continue to use the term harvest. I mean, words mean things.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
You know, it's not a harvest. It's a take. And, how do you stop the greed? The state of Michigan was logged off in 10 years. Then they moved to Wisconsin, and they did the same thing. And the state burned for 20 years. The duff, it's taken a long time, and it's not the same. And I can, you know, the whole idea of manage is, we can't even get the sewer systems to work right around anywhere. How do you manage an ecosystem, and where's the reverence for life? So I don't know. We got to be constantly on the alert for people who disregard science and the facts.
Okay, yeah. Listen. We got about 6 minutes and a couple other callers. Got to let you go. Thanks for calling.
Well, that's fine. Go ahead. I am enjoying it, but
yeah, okay.
in a lot of ways. So
yeah. All right.
Keep up the good work, and we all must keep vigilant. Thank you so much.
Right, and again, go to our program page at kbo.fm/Wednesday Talk Radio. And look at the links. There's a find out about for yourself and get involved with BARC, the local organization that works in Mount Hood. And let's go to Vinny. You're on the air.
Yeah, question. I kind of grew up around between Washougal and Stevenson, and I've been up there lately, and, you know, they have clear-cutted everything, but what are they using to spray? Because, you know, when they clear-cut something, they go and they kill everything after they've taken the trees out, and I'm wondering what you think they're spraying with. You there?
I'm not sure what they're spraying, but herbicide spraying on forest plantations is a big deal. Paul mentioned how down in southern Oregon people were sprayed and people are doing it. I know at one they were using 2,4-5-T, which of course is one of the ingredients in Agent Orange. But I'm not sure what they're spraying now. We did part of our Freedom of Information Act request on the fires as we asked them what they were spraying on that, and we still haven't got that information. They're being pretty...
Well, when did you guys request that?
Well, we requested it a couple months ago, and, you know, it's a Freedom of Information request is pretty interesting. I'm learning a lot here.
So, by the way, I've got some litigation expertise. How do I get a hold of you?
Oh, hey.
Well, call me up at the front desk after the show at 503-231-8032.
Okay.
231-8032. I'll be there about like 10 after 9.
Yeah, we'd love to talk to you.
And we can talk to you then.
Okay.
Thank you.
Bye.
We got one more caller that we have time for. I'm not sure your name, but go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, my name's Mark.
Go ahead.
Oh, yeah, just want to say thanks to you guys for putting on the show and all the great information. Thanks to that caller about Ben H. That was important information. I liked hearing that. And I also want to say, you know, there's no us and them. It's we, humans. It's what we do, whether we agree with it or not. And so we don't need to use words like old growth because that's the forestry term that they want to cut and harvest and take. And we need to use it as ancient forest and just remember it's ancient forest. It's not old growth. That's logging term.
Absolutely. In fact, I'm one of the four people that was there when we created the ancient forest movement and used that term. And that was James Monteith is the guy that came up with the term ancient forest. And that was his rationale. We went through all the other terms and we needed a term that wasn't the industry's term.
And, well, thank you for that. And I just wanted to bring that up and, you know, reiterate that point.
Yeah,
I appreciate all your information. And, you know, it's very, very helpful.
Good. Okay.
All right. And, you know, we're talking, you know, at the outset, I hope people listening now heard the history, but you can, again, get it, some of the history on some of the links. Michael Donnelly's got an article, and Brian Tokar has an article about the history of the Northwest Forest Plan. But yeah, those were heady times. I hope you heard it or listen to it again. You can. This show is archived with kbo.fm/Wednesday Talk Radio. You can listen to it if you didn't hear the whole thing. But get in. You know, there's a whole new chance to create a whole new movement right now, because boy, we need it on all fronts. We need to not be separate like we were at the time, because it's all connected at this time. We've got to fight the power all together. But in terms of protecting the forest, as I said, you know, BARC is working on it. There's Oregon Wild. There's a bunch of different groups, Friends of Brighton Bush Cascades. But, you know, if you're in a place where there isn't a group, start a group. Start your own research into what the Forest Service, the BLM, the state forests, the private lands, you know, start it. Do it.
Yeah.
We got about a couple minutes left. How do we wrap this up?
Well, I can tell you what our plans are. We've already made comments on this sale, and they haven't come out with their final plan yet. And I'm sure, like I said, I think they threw everything in there, and they're going to take a few things out that'll satisfy us. But we don't know if we'll be able to stop it. Especially, like I said, I think legislation is going to be coming that's going to suspend the laws. Back in the heyday of the old growth liquidation, 9 different times they suspended all the relevant environmental laws in order to get the cutout, you know. And that was a big bipartisan effort back then. It was mostly Mark Hatfield, who was a senator, Republican, and Les Coyne, who was a representative, who was a Democrat. And we got similar situation going on now. We really need to let Senator Ron Wyden know that this
is... DeFazio.
Well, I think Wyden and Merkley, the senators, are really good ones to start with. But yeah, DeFazio and Walden, they'll go along with what timber wants, you know. But I think there's some hope that we could get some change from the senators. Merkley's been stepping up on a lot of stuff lately. And
okay, we gotta close here, but people can still comment on this proposed Highway 46 thinning. There's a couple links to the government sites where you can get information about these and find out how to comment.
Yes, I highly recommend that. It doesn't matter. Sometimes I get thousands and thousands of comments, but they'll do what they want to do, but it's nice to get it on the record.
Okay. Well, thank you, Michael Donnelly. Appreciate it. It's been...
thanks a lot.
Paul Rowan with Wednesday Talk Radio here on KBOO. Thanks.